Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. On today's show, Sarah Weiss, Executive Director of the Nancy and David Wolfe Holocaust and Humanity Center, will join us to discuss the rise of anti-Semitism in this country. Judge Glock will take us back in time to explain the lost history of FDR's court packing scandal. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to break down maybe the busiest news week yet. And David Dayan will tell us why New York is not the only city that waged a war against Amazon. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. If you like the show, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member. Get our three-hour radio show commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up.
I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Now, Heather, that, of course, was Michael Cohen, the former consigliere to Donald Trump for a decade, maybe more, actually. And that was part of his opening statement from a really, I think, the most substantial committee hearing testimony that we have heard for a long time, regardless of whether you are a Russiagate skeptic or you are, you know, someone who is convinced that Donald Trump is a Manchurian candidate. What is really clear is that Donald Trump has some serious criminal liability. And Michael Cohen showed up with the receipts, Heather. And I got to say, I found the that riveting. And, you know, that, of course, was bookended. That took place on Wednesday of this week. That was bookended by a Tuesday and a Thursday testimony to the respective intel committees on the Hill and the Senate, which, of course, were closed door. But that open door hearing from Michael Cohen was really something.
Oh, it was really something. I mean, it was, and I think it was very significant. I mean, there are many reasons why, and I'll just, you know, agree with you that, you know, when you have these scandals brewing, as we've had over the past couple of years with Trump, or really since before he even, you know, was actually elected, Normally, the normal course of events is that we would have been seeing public hearings this whole time. I mean, this has been headline after headline in the news. We know there's major investigation. We know that there are U.S. attorneys looking into it. And yet the Congress has been, you know, more or less silent. If anything, what they've done is throw up a bunch of distractions about FISA courts and whatever, you know, taking on the FBI and the Department of Justice, acting as accomplices for Donald Trump, rather than doing the job that we would normally expect the Congress to do. Even if they were kangaroo courts, you would have expected some, you know, sort of fake
acknowledgement,
you know, kind of hearing,
of
you know,
right,
bringing in people who would refute all of it, or legal experts that would say it was all nonsense or whatever. But it's been silence. And that was a mistake, because what it's done is that it's built up this huge amount of energy, right, and interest in the whole thing. It's not just old news. It's for real. And here comes Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen, you know, for all of us, I mean, you know, he was a thug. He behaved as Trump's thug for 10 years. But I think it's important to remember something. This guy had an office right down the hallway from Donald Trump. He was an executive vice president and special counsel to the company. I mean, he wasn't just some guy down in the basement who was waiting for the call to go out and, you know, hold somebody up and tell him to shut up. He did all that stuff, but he had access. It's a very small company, and it was not some, you know, it's not some big organization. This is a small handful of people, and he was at the very top and involved in things that, as I think his testimony made clear, and more importantly, I think what he gave in that hearing was, you know, very, very sharp insight into the way that Donald Trump operates. And I think that that's extremely important, because what we're seeing is, as these cases are kind of, you know, churning around, and maybe the Mueller investigation is starting to, you know, come to some sort of conclusion or reaching some kind of you know, peak. We're seeing how Trump actually did all these things, and that's very, very important. I mean, I think that his testimony, you know, couched as it was with his narrative of, and I think this was really, really very compelling, was, right, look, I saw all this stuff. I was involved in all this stuff. I did all this stuff. I knew what he was. I'm telling you what he was. And I take responsibility for the fact that I kept working for him anyway. And at the end of it, there were a couple of questions that led him to say, look, I'm looking at you people. I did what you're doing. And look where I landed. Look where I am today. I'm about to go to prison because of what I did to help Donald Trump and cover up his crimes. And, you know, he didn't actually point to all of them, but he pretty much said to the Republicans on the panel, think twice. This guy will take you down too. And that's what's happened to me. And I take responsibility for it. But let's just say I did it for him as much as I did it for me.
I was really struck by both that and, you know, broadly speaking, look, I don't have any sympathies for Michael Cohen. And I have to say that, and I, you know, I certainly am not predisposed to believing a single word the guy says, but I found his testimony to be so credible because he was really basically, you know, he was up there buck naked. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, he was up there basically just saying, like, I'm going to jail. I messed up. I will take any criticism you get at me because it's really warranted. And, you know, he lives on the Upper West Side of New York City. I know peripherally the waters he swims in. His kids go to a private school up there. And I suspect that he is in a community where when certain things happen, like Charlottesville and whatnot, I don't think, you know, necessarily there was a problem with, like, the tax cuts, but things like Charlottesville and whatnot, I think that he was under a lot of pressure. I think there was a lot of social pressure at that time on him. And I believe that he had some, you know, moments of like, wait a second, what am I doing here? That were probably spurred on by, you know, those in his community and wanted to protect his kids, et cetera, et cetera. So I found his testimony compelling. It also, and we've got, I want to go through some more clips of what he did. What he brought out, but it also was incredibly revelatory about both the Republicans, as you say, them in the position of doing what Michael Cohen did for Donald Trump, covering for him, and also the Democrats. I mean, the difference between the members of this committee on the Republican and Democratic side could not have been more stark. And I will tell you this, that not only was it surprising to see a real hearing like this, because it's been a long time, right? I mean, you know, the Benghazi hearings, when they would question people, even then, it was all pretty, you know, pretty lame stuff. It really looks like the Republicans are out of practice at this. And I was shocked at the difference in like sort of the quality of the work. But we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this. There's a lot to talk about with these Cohen hearings. And of course, we've got Donald Trump failing in North Korea, both to distract and to sign a document. We've got some major legislation that has been proposed across the board. Stories of massive fundraising this week. What a crazy week. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, one of today's sponsors, BetterHelp.com/ROF. BetterHelp is an online service that gives you access to your own experienced, fully licensed therapist. You can do so by way of phone, video, or text. When you see a therapist in person in their office, it about takes 3 weeks on average before you're actually able to get your first appointment. But with BetterHelp, you're matched with a therapist who fits your needs within just 24 hours. And you get the same professional service. And the best part, BetterHelp is less expensive than seeing a therapist in person. Plus, you'll have totally unlimited access to the therapist. You can talk to them whenever you want, on your phone or on your computer. And because BetterHelp believes in what they do, they have a full money-back guarantee. If for whatever reason you're not happy with the service, you'll get a full refund, no questions asked. All of their therapists go through an extensive vetting process and are required to have at least 3 years of experience before joining BetterHelp. So you know you're getting someone who is fully qualified to help you. But if you don't think your therapist is a good fit, BetterHelp lets you switch to someone new at any time. Get started right now by going to BetterHelp.com/ROF. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, last segment, we're talking about the Michael Cohen testimony. Let's listen to some, you know, just in the opening statement in and of itself, we heard some stuff that is, you know, we sort of knew these stories, but to hear Michael Cohen just sort of lay them out, this is one where he just sums us up, but there was two clips about this. This, I thought, was hilarious.
A copy of an article with Mr. Trump's handwriting on it that reported on the auction of a portrait of himself that he arranged for the bidder ahead of time and then reimbursed the bidder from the account of his nonprofit charitable foundation, with the picture now hanging in one of his country clubs. And copies of letters I wrote at Mr. Trump's direction that threatened his high school, colleges, and the college board not to release his grades or SAT scores.
Okay, so that is Michael Cohen talking about the receipts. He's got the documents. He's not just alleging this. He's bringing in documents that prove that Donald Trump paid a guy to go to an auction and bid up the price of a portrait of him, so that it made it look like people really wanted his picture. And then he sent letters to his high school, for God's sakes, in the SATs, threatening them with God knows what if they were to in some way release the story. Like, what a small little man. That's nuts.
It's completely nuts. I mean, the portrait thing is truly unbelievable. I mean, this is, you know, there was nothing he wouldn't stoop to doing to hype himself. And it continues to this day. But the SAT thing, I've got to tell you, nothing has made me more want to see those college
right.
and high school records. Because remember, look, this guy portrays himself as a business genius. We know that's not true. And we know that, but you know, a lot of people believed it. They didn't understand that he had basically, you know, inherited a huge fortune and then squandered it over and over again and just sort of managed to keep afloat by dancing as fast as he could and becoming a celebrity, basically. Basically, and being able to brand his name, that he's not a business genius at all. He's kind of a self-promoting genius in a certain way, but that's about it. And so, you know, I do think there's some, you know, that there's interest in it. But the fact that he did this after dogging Barack Obama over his college transcripts, he even offered him $1 million to his favorite charity if he'd release them over and over again, you know, implying that he had a low IQ, which is what he says about every African-American that
right.
you know, he has a conflict with. They're stupid, right? So he said this about Barack Obama, for crying out loud, who's the head of the law review, you know. But he said this, and now, you know, you realize once again, we all have this, you know, many of us have been, you know, sort of hyping this idea that Trump projects all of his own insecurities and failures onto other people. But this is a truly perfect example of that.
Right.
This is a guy who, you know, obviously has something to hide. I mean, if he got straight A's in college, he would have no objection to that being released, obviously. So the fact that he didn't want anybody to release those says that, you know, clearly, I mean, it may not be bad. Maybe he was just a B student or something. But for him, because he's touted himself as his genius, it's a real problem. And so he has his you know, fixer write threatening letters to these colleges. And Fordham actually admitted that they had it and that they had been, you know, threatened with legal action if they released the thing. They came out with a statement. So I don't know about Penn, which is where he, you know, he went
right.
for the second 2 years of his college career, or his high school, the military academy that he went to. But, you know, maybe they've given statements too. But, I mean, imagine that, somebody going to that length to hide something. And this is true of Trump. In, you know, it's, this is one small example that illustrates all the rest, right?
Right.
He is hiding things over and over and over again.
And I don't know, obviously, look, that's not illegal, and I don't think his audience is going to care about it. But here is something that I do think may make a slight difference if Democrats were to play this up. And, you know, we're a couple of years out. But if this ends up in an election ad, I wouldn't be surprised. Here's Michael Cohen talking about a guy who about his deferment from Vietnam, and Cohen wanting to get the information out there about his medical problems.
Mr. Trump claimed it was because of a bone spur. But when I asked for medical records, he gave me none and said that there was no surgery. He told me not to answer the specific questions by reporters, but rather offer simply the fact that he received a medical deferment. He finished the conversation with the following comment. You think I'm stupid? I'm not going to Vietnam.
I think that comment, you think I'm stupid, I'm not going to Vietnam, is one that actually might have some traction. And of course, I'm talking about with a very, very narrow slice of even his electorate. But I think there are some who might be really turned off by that, even more so than the John McCain thing, because it's one thing to say that John McCain, this elite, you know, son of an admiral, was not all he was cracked up to be. It's another to say, if you're a Vietnam vet, you're stupid. You went. I didn't. And that's basically the message that he's sending there. And it's just a question of whether that is something that the Democrats end up exploiting. But listen, Heather, we've got to take a break. What I want to do when we return is look a little bit more at two elements of what Cohen talked about. And that is obviously Donald Trump's racism, which led to an exchange between one of the new members of Congress, the Democratic women, and an old white Republican guy. And then let's talk about collusion. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire. Just add why New York is not the only city waging a fight against Amazon. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I've been rolling on the freeway. I've been riding 85. I've been thinking way too much. And I'm way too gonna drive. I got anger in my chest. I got milkings on my mind. And you didn't fit the picture. So I guess you want the...
You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. It's one-third of what you could be listening for just a couple of bucks a week. Less. Check it out. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Become a member. You get the full show without commercials, plus total access to our over 10-year big archive with all your favorite guests. Hear from Bobby Kennedy. Hear from Mike Papantonio. Check it out. ROFpodcast.com. It's our members that make this show possible. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Recently, Amazon backed out of its plan to build its HQ2 facility in New York City. Now they've turned their sights on one of the runner-ups, Nashville. Here to tell us how Nashville is fighting back against the online retailer, investigative reporter David Dayan. So, David, there remains considerable controversy in New York about the whole Amazon headquarters, I guess the breakup, if you will, the short-lived romance and relationship, and we are fortunately nothing was official, and so the divorce was clean. There were no children involved. I think the
question, Sam, is will Amazon Cuomo keep his name after the divorce, much like many, many, many do, or will he change it back to Andrew?
That's correct. We don't know that. That is unclear. I have no insight into Amazon Cuomo's thinking on this. The biggest losers, it depends on who you talk to, but the most definitive, measurable losers at this point, right? Because we were always talking about hypotheticals in this situation. If Amazon actually delivered the jobs, if, you know, there was a lot of hypotheticals. But the most material losers, at least in the short run, are those Amazon executives who knew that New York and Queens was going to be picked and bought real estate in that area. Now, with that said, but now that, well, at first blush.
I would argue that's wonderful. But I would argue that the biggest losers are actually large corporations, because what this entire sweepstakes auction, whatever you have want to call it, did was lay bare this economic race to the bottom, where cities have to grovel and beg and offer bribes to corporations to get them to move their locations. And Amazon just raised the awareness on this a millionfold. And every other company that's going to come after and seek these millions of dollars, sometimes billions of dollars, are going to have to come up against the fact that the public just doesn't like this idea.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the struggle that's going on with Nashville, but staying on New York, I think that was part of the reason why this happened in New York in terms of it setting a precedent, because you know, people, and we can get into some of the details here, but at the end of the day, regardless of whether you believe the claims that Amazon was going to create these jobs, regardless of whether you believe the claims that there would be a net positive in terms of economic activity for the city, the reality is that New York City the arguably the most vibrant, you know, 10 mile radius of economic activity mm-hmm. in the country, and one that is a very strong union city, one of the most sort of like economically powerful buyers, if you will, of corporations coming for headquarters. If they gave the store essentially to the wealthiest company, you know, more or less in the world, the wealthiest guy in the world who could come there, that's basically saying that New York is not in a position to deny anybody. And that if Jeff Bezos is worthy of a subsidy, what company wouldn't be? And if Jeff Bezos didn't have to give anything for a subsidy, what company would be? And that was one of the big sort of like, I think, less covered aspects of this, is that the precedent that was being set, and Amazon surely knew that too about the precedent.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think that you have to look at this in the sense of who has the value. Does Amazon have the value by virtue of being a company that can site X number of jobs in a portion of New York City? Or does New York City have the value by virtue of being New York City, being a place with a huge workforce, incredible amount of talent, the entertainment location in terms of being the world financial sector, having access to all these other industries that companies like an Amazon are interested in? The value is in New York. The value is not in Amazon. And the idea that New York, with all of these factors in its favor, needs to pay for anything is really just ridiculous. And the idea, it's actually made plainly ridiculous by the fact that Amazon has 5,000 employees in New York City. They are not leaving. And in fact, Amazon said in its announcement that it would not site HQ2 in New York, said that we will be expanding our operations in New York City and adding more people. So they get $0 for those additional workers, but they're doing it because they know they have to be in New York City. And that's the real point here.
And I would add that despite the fact that I was being a little bit glib about those Amazon executives who went and bought real estate in Queens in Long Island City, you know, in anticipation of Amazon moving there. When I say that they're losers, it's only insofar as like the rate, the pace of the increase of the value of that property. Because indicative [S2] Right. [S1] Of the strength of New York City is that there is no doubt in my mind that whatever they bought in terms of real estate in 5 years is going to be worth significantly more than anywhere else probably they could have bought in the United States. And it's just not going to be.
For two reasons. Number one is what you just said, that Long Island City is a gentrifying area, and it's going to attract businesses because it's New York City, and that money will be put to use. And that those properties will be developed and cost out higher than when they were bought. And number two, Long Island City is a federal opportunity zone. And what that means is it's a giant tax dodge to buy properties and develop properties in Long Island City, the site where the Amazon location was going to be. This is a separate kind of boondoggle from the Trump tax cuts that created these federal opportunity zones and had seemingly no standards on where those would be put, including in gentrifying areas. But, you know, these individuals are going to make out great on this real estate deal, just not in the way they thought they would.
And so that's a completely separate subsidy. And just to be clear here on the New York stuff, and then, you know, we'll take a break and we'll talk specifically about Nashville. But we heard the number $3 billion. And there, I think about 500 million of that were direct payments, were actual payments or subsidies to Amazon. The other $2.5 billion were essentially taxes that New York City, New York State would not collect, assuming the same amount of economic activity was to go on there. And I guess the question is, like, how much do you believe there will be economic activity that will go on there? I think you got to believe there's going to be a lot. I mean, it's not like
I think people. I agree with you, and I think people like Andrew Ross Sorkin are embarrassing themselves when they say that New York City lost $27 billion in tax revenue. The idea that there won't be 25,000 high-paying jobs, that New York is hard up for high-paying jobs in the corporate sector, is ridiculous. And this idea that there's lost tax revenue coming in is just inaccurate. New York City is going to have the number of jobs that are able to be supported by the city. It always has been that way, and it always will be that way. And New York is not, East Podunk, Ohio, where they need the company to town to come in and revitalize the city. It's New York City.
Right.
They're not going to have a problem filling that office space.
New York is not Detroit, and it's also not, 1975 in New York. And so, all right, well, we got to take a break. Let's talk about Nashville, because Nashville gets a little bit closer to that sort of model where, hey, maybe Nashville doesn't have the same sort of like bargaining power as New York. And we will talk about that when we return. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio, talking to the great David Dane.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with the investigative reporter David Dane about his piece, New York Isn't the Only City Waging a Fight Against Amazon. So, David, in the last segment, we were talking about the dynamic in New York City. Amazon packing up, leaving, divorcing. We have no idea what's going to happen to little Amazon Cuomo, whether he will change his name back to
custody?
Andrew. Yes, it's very hard to know what's going to happen to him. But like we've said, Amazon's going to continue to expand there. They're not even going to build this headquarters, which also leads me to believe that it was very New York specific from day one. Right. Like if this was really, you would imagine they would have a second place runner up for this after they had done their big sweepstakes. Apparently they don't. Which suggests that New York could have attracted them. The reason why they decided to forego it is because they didn't want the precedent of giving into significant demands by city and community leaders who wanted, you got to be more union friendly. You got to be you got to contribute instead of suck out of the community. They didn't want to set that precedent. So let's talk about Nashville, because Nashville, what happened in Nashville?
So this is interesting. I mean, the same that Amazon announced that they were going to put these headquarters in New York City and the Washington area, they also announced this small facility, and it's actually called this an Operations Center of Excellence, that they were going to place in Nashville. Nashville was one of the 20 finalists for HQ2, and it represents what I feel like was the real intent of HQ2, to get all this information from all these cities all over the country in terms of what they'd be willing to give to Amazon, in terms of where their urban planning and development was, where their educational facilities were, everything like that. and then turn around and use that information and monetize it. So they announced this facility in Nashville. It's for 5,000 employees. It's in a facility called Nashville Yards, which is a development in downtown Nashville that's being built right now, was already being built in an office tower that was already being built that Amazon's just going to rent. The reason there aren't tax subsidies in this deal is because Amazon's renting the building, so they can't get property tax abatements. But they are getting $102 million from the city and state, almost all of that in cash grants, almost all of that in cash. And to the extent that because of the demise of the New York plan, more jobs go into Nashville, that will be even more cash that they will be able to acquire. Nashville, much like many cities across the country, has serious problems with affordable housing, real problems with congestion. Several freeways converge on Nashville, and the assumption is local residents will not be getting these 5,000 high-paying logistics management jobs, and so that will only increase the gentrification, which is happening all over the city. It will be a strain on transportation because there is pretty much no public transportation in Nashville. And so this will all add cars and congestion. And this money is being given to Amazon at a time when, because of some issues involving property taxes, which I get into in the piece, the property tax rate ends up being the lowest in the history of the city of Nashville. And promised raises, cost of living raises for city employees, which were promised in 2017, have had to be reneged. So the city workers are not getting the raise they were promised. And at the same time, Amazon is getting $102 million.
Because ostensibly these jobs coming from Amazon are going to make the city thrive, and theoretically it will then allow them to raise, to generate taxes and then pay their employees more. But they're actually not.
And by the way, Nashville is thriving. I mean, Nashville is already thriving. Nashville has done what economic development experts would say is the thing you would have to do so that you wouldn't have to make these payouts. They have become a tourism destination. They have very good educational facilities led by Vanderbilt University. They're in an area which is ripe for logistics. FedEx and UPS are right in the area. If you want to be a logistics company, you have to be in that area. So they don't really need to give these subsidies once again. And yet they are making this choice of funding Amazon when they can't even fund their own workers.
That's stunning. And I mean, has there been any type of pushback? Because we're talking about the actual cash grants here. And I have to say the whole sweepstakes, you know, as the tour, as the lottery, as they went around, reminds me of back in my acting days where you'd come in for an audition and they'd say, improv a couple of characters. They would say, thank you, we're not going to hire you. But then all of a sudden those characters end up being in the show that they were doing.
Right.
And there's that quality.
Right. I think it's
to
similar
this.
To that.
Writing for us. And as part of your audition, we don't want you, but we'll take the writing. And
it's a way to monetize all this information that they were able to acquire. And it's not limited to Nashville. Boston was a finalist and ended up getting a big facility. Raleigh was a finalist. It found out Raleigh was touting all of its growth in its area. And then they put a warehouse right next door to Raleigh. So this is a pattern, and it's a persistent pattern. There is some pushback in Nashville, but the legislative, the city council is, not to the degree of the progressive nature of the New York City Council.
Right.
And so far, those efforts have not moved forward that much. But there is a substantial sort of union-backed effort, particularly around the city employees. I was down there last month. I saw the city workers give sort of a giant blown up invoice to the city council saying this is past due. This is money you promised in a budget that you owed us and you're not giving it to us while you're paying out Amazon. It kind of shocks the conscience. And so, you know, we'll see what they're able to do. Amazon has not finalized, the city, I should say, has not finalized this cash subsidy to Amazon. So there is still some room to run here. And we'll see if the momentum from the cancellation of the New York headquarters fans out across the country.
Well, this is going to be a story that I think we're going to see more of, not just in terms of Amazon, but other companies. But certainly you set the precedent that we can reject the coercion by a massive company like Amazon. I think it's going to embolden other communities. David Dayan, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
David Dayan is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. He's also a contributing writer to Salon.com and The Intercept, and a weekly columnist for The New Republic and The Fiscal Times. When we come back, Heather Digby-Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com. Check out the podcast.